Well, today we celebrate Father's Day, a day that's been set aside to honor and perhaps to remember our earthly fathers who have impacted our lives. Now, for many, it's a day of joy, a time to receive gifts, to receive cards, perhaps a time to get together with family to share a meal and memories. And I know that I'm looking forward to this afternoon to be with my daughter and son-in-law and my two grandsons down in Delaware. And perhaps you have family gatherings planned as well for today or for this weekend. But I know that for others, it's not a day of joy, but more of a day of sadness, perhaps even depressing, for their children may not honor nor remember them on Father's Day. Today may remind many of a poor relationship which they had with their earthly father, or perhaps this day brings out memories of our dads which are no longer with us. Yesterday marked the 36th anniversary of my father's move to heaven. And he did not live long enough to see our youngest daughter, Abigail, born, much less his great-grandsons, Joshua and Samuel. He missed so much of his family life, which I'm sure he would have loved. But you know, there's not a week that goes by that I do not think of him, especially when involved in fixing something around the house or helping out my daughter. I see my dad and my grandson, Sammy. They both have this smirky smile. And I don't know where it came from, but I looked at that and said, that's my dad. Missed a generation, missed a couple generations, but he certainly has my dad's smile. And I learned much from my dad, not just his mechanical skills, but my dad loved the Lord, loved his family, faithfully served in various capacities at the church where my mom is still regularly attends. He was not a perfect dad. He had his flaws. He carried into his marriage and into our home baggage from his upbringing. But he overcame much by God's grace to provide a lasting role model for me, for which I am grateful. I also remember today my father-in-law, Bill Beebe, who became like a father to me when my dad passed. And he too left a lasting legacy, a great role model of someone who worked hard, had a generous spirit, loved his family, loved the Lord, and who served God faithfully. So I have been truly blessed with these two fathers who I honor on this Father's Day. But where did the idea ever come about creating a day, especially for fathers? Well, the tradition began in Spokane, Washington. A woman by the name of Sonora Smart Dodd thought of the idea of Father's Day while listening to a Mother's Day sermon in 1909. Mrs. Dodd's father, William Jackson Smart, was widowed when his wife died in childbirth while delivering their sixth child. And despite the obvious hardship, Mr. Smart proceeded to raise the newborn along with his five other children by himself. Her father made all the parental sacrifices, taking care of the children plus earning a living as a single parent. It wasn't until Sonora Dodd became an adult that she realized the strength and selflessness her father had shown. And so out of gratitude for her father and for all good fathers, she chose to hold the first Father's Day celebration in Spokane, Washington, on June the 19th, 1910. About the same time, in various towns and cities across America, other people were beginning to celebrate Father's Day. But it was not until 1924 that President Calvin Coolidge recommended it as a national holiday. But it took quite a few years before it actually became a national holiday. It was not until 1972. When President Richard Nixon established a permanent national observance of Father's Day on the third Sunday of June. And so Father's Day was born in memory and gratitude by a daughter who thought that her father and all good fathers should be honored with a special day, just like we honor our mothers on Mother's Day. Since 1942, the National Father's Day Committee has been conferring the Father of the Year award to honor contemporary lifestyle leaders of our society. General Douglas MacArthur was the first recipient of the award, and each year since then, they've selected more than one recipient. And here's just a sampling of those who in the past have won the National Father of the Year Award. Men like Dwight Eisenhower, Jack Benny, Bing Crosby, Harry Truman, Frank Sinatra, Bob Hope, Babe Ruth, Robert Young of Father Knows Best, James Stewart, Henry Fonda, Danny Thomas, Danny Kaye, Billy Graham. That's one we might know. Ronald Reagan, Andy Griffith, Robert Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, and then some more recent recipients include George Foreman, Alonzo Mourning, Patrick Ewing, Donald Trump, Larry King, Archie Manning, Hulk Hogan, Dwayne Wade, George W. Bush, and Michael Strahan. And this year's recipients of Father of the Year Awards are the following: Emmanuel Chirico, who is Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of the PVH Corporation. Maria Lopez, who is an Emmy Award-winning host and New York Times best-selling author. And Mario, what did I say? Oh, Maria. No, sorry about that. Mario. Mario Lopez. Can't read my notes here. And the other one is Willie Geist, who's host of NBC News Sunday Today with Willie Geist and co-host of MSNBC's Morning Joe. Those are the ones who received Father of the Year awards this year. Now, I'm not sure as to the criteria used to judge the Father of the Year award. Personally, I do not know these men. Perhaps they were all excellent fathers who provided loving leadership to their families. I don't know. I do suspect, though, that a different criteria is used to bestow this honor. That the honor is given more for their leadership contribution to the community and business affairs, or for their ability to contribute money or name recognition to the charitable cause of the Father's Day Council, which is Save the Children Foundation, rather than the quality of their parenting skills as good fathers. That's only a hunch of mine that I have.
It's a good one, yes.
A good one, though, huh? This morning, though, we're going to take a short break from our study in the book of Galatians to consider the question, what makes a good father? What criteria can we use to evaluate dad? How does God evaluate us? What kind of man would God nominate for Father of the Year award? What does God look for when he desires to honor somebody? And to answer those questions, we're going to meet a man this morning whom God honors. He, in fact, is a dad. He is a father. He had two sons to his wife, Zipporah, Gershom and Eliezer. Now, we don't know what kind of a father he was, our nominee was, at home, because he spent much of his later years on the road. For this man was the father of an extended family, the children of Israel. Of course, I'm speaking about Moses. He fathered the nation as they moved from Egypt to the promised land. And on one occasion, God honors Moses, honors him for the qualities that sets him apart as a leader, as the dad of this large family. And Moses receives God's Father of the Year award. Now, what qualities set him apart from the rest? Now, as it's true in life, the inner qualities of a person surface during times of adversity, both the good and the bad. It's when times are tough, the pressure is on, that the true measure of a person is revealed. And such is the case in our text for today. As we come to Numbers chapter 12, the people are camped at Hazeroth en route to the land of Canaan. They had just left Kibroth Hattaavah, an area so named because there the people grumbled against God because of the lack of variety in their food. It was there that God miraculously provided quail, more than enough for 30 days. And it was while camped at Kibroth Hattaavah that Moses appointed 70 spirit-controlled, peer-respected men to help carry the load of leading this great people. But it was also here that the anger of the Lord broke out against this people for their ungrateful, unthankful spirit. Now you would think with what just happened, with this great blessing of God, that everybody in the camp would be happy. But they were not. In fact, what happens here brought to the forefront a simmering undercurrent. There is a breach in the leadership team of Moses, his brother Aaron, and their sister Miriam. Look at the conflict beginning at verse 1 of chapter 12. It says, "Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. So they said, 'Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?' And the Lord heard it." Now I've learned over the years that whenever people are upset with those in leadership, there's usually a surface issue that masks the real underlying cause of the conflict. There is a presenting problem that people have, but the real issue lies underneath. And such is the case here. Now, the presenting issue, the surface issue, is Moses' marriage to an Ethiopian woman. Perhaps more accurately, a Cushite woman. Now, we're not sure who this woman is. Some scholars believe that this is a reference to Zipporah, his wife, his first wife, who was a Midianite, and that this reference to her as a Cushite or an Ethiopian was a derogatory, demeaning slur on her character. Zipporah and her two boys joined Moses at Sinai, and so she's accompanying them a little bit on this trip. Perhaps Miriam was feeling threatened or misplaced, or perhaps felt that Zipporah had too much power or influence over Moses, and this caused her to speak against Moses' marriage to her. You know, in-law relationships can be tough. At times, we may not like the spouse of our brother or of our sister. We may not get along with them. They married into the family just like we did. So this may be the case here. Or it could be that Zipporah had died, for we find no mention of her after Exodus chapter 18, and no mention that Moses was ever a polygamist, that he had more than one wife. So perhaps Zipporah died and Moses remarried a Cushite woman. Now, may I say to you, marriage itself should not be criticized, since the Cushites were not among those whom the Israelites were forbidden to marry. They were commanded in the law not to marry daughters of the Amorites, Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, but Cushites were not on that list. Only the high priest under the law was commanded to marry a Hebrew virgin. Now, some have theorized that Miriam was upset because this was an interracial marriage. A fairer-skinned Moses with a darker-skinned wife. But Cushites were not necessarily of a different color, since people of that name existed both in Arabia and in Cush proper. Plus, may I say, there's no place in Scripture where we are prohibited from marrying people of other races. Some seek to twist the scriptures to teach otherwise and to support their prejudices, but the Bible is silent about interracial marriage. The only prohibition when it comes to marriage of a believer is marrying a believer with an unbeliever. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 that a wife is bound by law to her husband as long as her husband lives, but if her husband dies, she is at liberty to be married to whom she wishes only in the Lord. That's the only stipulation. Only in the Lord. A believer marrying another believer. Now, all of this conjecture over the identity of the Cushite woman and why she upset Miriam really is worthless, because that wasn't the real problem. That wasn't the real reason why they were upset with Moses. It's only the smokescreen, the surface issue. And the real hidden cause is found in verse 2, where they say, "So they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?" And the Lord heard it. The real reason, the real cause, the underlying cause, the thing that was going on, is that there was envy. There was jealousy. They were miffed. Perhaps that Moses had failed to consult them on the choice of the 70 Spirit-filled men. I mean, who does he think he is, going around without consulting us? Who made him the head honcho around here? After all, doesn't God speak to us like he speaks to Moses? I mean, I'm Aaron. I'm the chief priest. I'm the high priest. I wear the breastplate with the Urim and the Thummim through which I can discern the decisions and will of the Lord. I've been appointed to this place of leadership, just like Moses. I've been the chief spokesman. How dare he go ahead and make decisions without consulting me? Or I'm Miriam. I'm the prophetess who led the congregation in worship after the Red Sea incident. God spoke to me then. In fact, my song is in the record of Scripture. And so God's spoken through both of us. Who does Moses think that he is? Professional jealousy. Professional jealousy and envy. Many times leadership teams are made up of people who are leaders in and of their own right, who have to lay aside their egos and somehow work together with other leaders to accomplish a common goal. You know, Jesus' disciples, they were constantly jockeying for position, quarreling over who would be considered the greatest in the kingdom, envious of those who appear to have gotten a better deal or who Jesus liked best. Leaders, you know, can also have thin skin and get their feelings hurt easily if they're passed over, not acknowledged, not consulted. And right now, the leadership team over this trek to the land of Israel is in danger of unraveling. And not just a leadership team, but a family. This was Moses' brother and Moses' sister. And we have a brother and a sister against a brother. The family was coming apart. And God steps in. And God holds, in the midst of the conflict, God holds the God Choice Award. God's Choice Award. Look what happens, verse 3. It says, "Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth. Suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron and Miriam, come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting." So the three came out. "Then the Lord came down in the pillar of the cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both went forward. Then he said, hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I speak with him face to face, even plainly and not in dark sayings, and he sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?" So the anger of the Lord was roused against them, and he departed. Now, God summons the three, and God's choice is Moses. Now, why does God honor Moses? What qualities are in Moses that God highlights? What is God looking for in someone that he honors? And what would God be looking for those that would be the father of the year, you and I? First of all, he looks for humility. Humility. Verse 3 says, "Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth." Frankly, that verse is a little awkward, isn't it? Especially if we believe, as I believe, that Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. And so it sounds a little bit like Moses is here blowing his own horn, that he is proud that he's humble. And I've heard it said that humility is the one character trait that if you think you have it, you probably have just lost it. And so humility is not, and so we find though here he's saying he was the most humble man that ever walked the face of the earth to that time. Of all the men who were on the face of the earth. What is humility? Well, humility is seeing, is having a, not thinking less of oneself, but of thinking soberly about oneself. Paul kind of defines it in Romans chapter 12, verse 3, where he says, "For I say, through the grace given to me, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith." And so humility is seeing myself as God sees me, not more nor less. And as Moses looked at himself soberly, he saw that he was more humble or meek than anyone else, and the Spirit of God, I believe, directed him to record his assessment as truth. Now, there has to be some collaborative evidence to support such a claim. How can God say that Moses was the humblest person alive at the time? Well, there's a number of pieces of evidence that we could cite. First of all, we could cite Moses' selfless concern. His selfless concern. See, on numerous occasions, he's interceding on behalf of the people. Moses kind of puts his life on the line. On more than one occasion, Moses was more concerned with the well-being of the group that he was with than his own life. You know, when the nation of Israel broke the law of God from the very institution of it at Mount Sinai, it says that the Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I will consume them, and I will make of you a great nation." Moses, here's your big chance. Here is your big chance of getting rid of these chronic complainers, these grumblers, and these people that everything's always wrong. Just sit back and I'm going to zap them. I will wipe them out. And then I'm going to start all over. And Moses, I'm going to make out of you into a great nation. Tempting, I'm sure. But Moses would have none of it. I mean, he pleaded with the Lord on their behalf. He reminded God of the covenant that he had made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And one stipulation of the covenant being that I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven. And all this land that I've spoken of, I give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. And as a result, the Lord relented from the harm which he said he would do to his people. Moses then confronted the people with their sins and the dire consequences for their disobedience. He offers to be the mediator between the disobedient people and their holy God and to make atonement for their sin. He returns to speak to the Lord and he said, "Oh, these people have committed a great sin and have made for themselves a god of gold. Yet now, if you will, forgive their sins. But if not, I pray, blot me out of your book which you have written." Wow. See, Moses was not self-centered. He was other-centered. Paul tells us in Philippians chapter 2 that says, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than themselves. This is a selfless, the selfless concern that we are to have. You know, Moses never knew the meaning of the Greek word for selfless love, agape love, but he certainly lived it. He gave himself for the benefit of the children of Israel. It was a selfless concern. May I remind all of us that that's the kind of love you and I, who are husbands and dads, are to have for our families. We are commanded to love your wife just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present to himself a glorious church, not having spot nor wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy without blemish. In leading our homes and families, we're to have that kind of selfless concern. Our interests are how to please our wives, how to serve our families, how to enable them to be all that God intends for them to be, how to enable them to reach their God-given potentials. As father and a husband, we're not to be served, but to serve. And in that loving service, we provide the leadership for the home. The kind of leadership that is easy for the wife to submit to and for the children to respect. One of the reasons we honor our fathers today is because we saw in them, perhaps imperfectly displayed, but we observed selfless concern. Their concern was not for themselves, but for their families, for you and for me, their children. Love in action. Dads may not have to say, I love you, or rarely so, but by their actions, willingness to forgo what they want in order to put their family first, demonstrates the love. Selfless concern. His humility was also seen, not just in his selfless concern, but in his lack of a competitive spirit. Look back at Numbers chapter 11, verse 24. Numbers 11, 24. It says, so Moses went and told the people the words of the Lord, and he gathered the 70 men of the elders of the people and placed them around the tabernacle. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke to him and took of the spirit that was upon him and placed the same upon the 70 elders. And it happened when the Spirit rested upon them that they prophesied, although they never did so again. But two men had remained in the camp. The name of one was Eladad, and the name of the other Medad, and the Spirit rested upon them. Now they were among those listed, but who had not gone out to the tabernacle, yet they prophesied in the camp. And a young man ran and told Moses and said, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. So Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, one of his choice men, answered and said, Moses, my Lord, forbid them. Then Moses said to him, are you zealous for my sake? Oh, that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his spirit upon them. And Moses returned to the camp, he and the elders of Israel. Now here is a fresh, vivid illustration in the life of Moses that he was not driven by a competitive spirit. That is, where he had to be the top dog, first and the only one. Eldad and Medad missed the meeting, and yet they too were prophesying. And Joshua thought that their prophesying outside of the camp was somehow taking away from the authority of Moses. That God spoke through Moses or his representative, and here were two outside of the camp also speaking for the Lord. They are Moses' competition. But Moses doesn't see them as a threat. He's not caught up in being first, but instead he has a cooperative spirit whereby he sees himself as only one of many who are filled with the Spirit and speaking on behalf of God. And if Moses would have his way, he says everybody would be filled with the Spirit and ministering in that way. See, it takes humility. It takes a humble man to recognize that God can use other people. Now, this incident shows how wrong Miriam and Aaron were about Moses. For Moses did not believe that God spoke only through him. He had that lack of a competitive spirit. I don't know what your dad was like growing up, but I trust, my dad would let me win every now and then when we played. And it's great when you have a dad like that, when your dad pitches the ball so you can hit it. He's not trying to strike you out all the time. And he's not trying to prove that he's the big ball player who can beat a little kid. Having a dad that's secure enough to let you win. It's great to have a father who doesn't have to be one up on you all the time. Who is not interested in putting you or keeping you in your place. Who is not always trying to outdo you or to show you up. Father who doesn't have to come in first or win all the time. A lack of competitiveness. Humility. I think humility is also seen in Moses' selfless stance. His selfless concern, his non-competitive spirit, and in his non-defensive stance. When Miriam and Aaron accuse Moses of thinking that he's the only one through whom God speaks, we have no record that Moses tried to defend himself against the allegations of wrongdoing. When the honor of God was at stake, such as in the case of the golden calf, no man was more zealous in the defense of God and his honor than Moses. But here, when his own honor is at stake, no more man more meek than Moses. Like the Savior, when he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. Moses allows God to come to his defense and plead his case. A non-defensive state. Now, how quick are you and how quick am I to defend ourselves, especially when challenged by our spouse or by our children? How readily do we admit our mistakes when wrong and ask for forgiveness? How open are we to hear the criticism of others, especially those closest to us, and to remain silent? All of that takes humility. Selflessness, cooperative spirit, non-defensive stance, humble, meek, having the power to crush or tear apart or destroy, but keeping that power under control. That was Moses. And I trust that describes you and I as well. You know, James says that God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. And he goes on to say, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. The man that God honors is a man who's humble, a humble man. Secondly, the man that God honors is faithful. It's faithful. Look at what the text says in verse 6. It says, then he said, hear now my words. Is there a prophet among you? I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. Faithful. Faithful. Moses is faithful in all my house. The writer of Hebrews quotes from this passage in Hebrews chapter 3, and he adds this commentary. Moses was indeed faithful in all his house as a servant for a testimony of those things which would be spoken afterward. See, God had trusted Moses to be a spokesperson, to be one who would deliver to the nation exactly what was on God's mind. And Moses did a great job. He was faithful in carrying out the responsibility that God had given to him, but he also had a responsibility to be the man in the middle to represent the people fairly before God as their mediator or their intercessor. And Moses had carried out this responsibility with integrity. He was a good, honest man who aimed at nothing else than to honor God and the welfare of the nation. And he faithfully served God, kept his promises, refused to give up, even during some very testy times. And indeed, he went through some very testy times. Mundane, testy times. They wandered 40 years in the wilderness, setting up camp, tearing it down, burying the dead, moving a few miles on, setting up camp, tearing it down, burying the dead, moving on, day in, day out, 40 years, doing the same thing with the same group of gripers and complainers. I'm sure there were days when Moses second-guessed his decision to lead this group of people. I'm sure there were times when Moses questioned his own commitment, whether he could go on another day and ready to walk away from leadership, ready to quit. I'm sure there were some days when he would have wished that God would have wiped them all out and started all over. And yet none of those times are recorded. What we do find is a man who's willing to stay, willing to lead, even if the group is going no place, willing to tough it out, willing to do what God has commissioned him to do. He's in this for the long haul. There is no bailing out, no walking away from his family. He's faithful. The steady hand throughout the journey. Faithful. Faithfulness. You know, Paul, in defending his apostleship to the church of Corinth, he writes this. He says, "Let a man so consider us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mystery of God. Moreover, it's required in stewards that one be found faithful." Faithfulness. That's what God's looking for in you and I. Faithfulness. Men and women who will continue to serve, continue to minister, continue to love, continue to stand for the truth and proclaim the truth when the going gets tough, when there is no spirit, there's a spiritual drought in the land, where there's no evidence of fruitfulness in the mundane of ministering day in and day out, faithful to the Lord. That's what God honors. For Paul goes on to say that God will judge his own servants, that each one will receive their praise from God. We labor to hear those words, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." You know, one of the things I appreciate the most about my dad was his faithfulness. He was faithful to my mom. Faithful in keeping his marriage vows. Faithful in working hard. Many times he worked two jobs to provide for my brother and my two sisters. Day in and day out, he would go to the mill. He worked a swing shift. They worked 7 days a week. He was committed to his family to provide for us. My dad was never famous, but he was faithful. And I honor the memory of him today. God honors those who are humble. He honors those who are faithful. There's one more quality that God looks for in the Father of the Year, and that is God honors those who live in fellowship with him. Look at verse 6. Again, he says, "Is there a prophet among you? I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I speak with him face to face, even plainly and not in dark sayings. And he sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?" Moses lived in fellowship with God. There's no denying it. Moses had an intimate personal relationship with the living God and enjoyed unparalleled sweet fellowship with him. In the tent of meetings, God would meet personally with Moses. And so intense was that encounter that when Moses emerged from the tent, his face would glow with holy sunburn. He was in the very presence of God. He'd been in the magnificent presence of God, and his appearance was transformed, and he wore a veil over his face because of the glow. On another occasion, according to Exodus 33, God shows Moses his goodness and grace, and he gave him a glimpse of his glory as he hid Moses in the cleft of the rock and covered him with his hand. Moses heard more from God than any other prophet, more clearly and distinctively. He spent 40 days up on Mount Sinai receiving instruction in the law. Moses saw more of God than any other prophet, for he enjoyed face-to-face, open communication with God. It was said of Moses that the Lord spoke to Moses face-to-face as a man speaks to his friend. God honors those who live in fellowship with Him, who enjoy an intimate communion with the Father. In fact, so intense was the relationship between God and Moses, they were so close that God asked Aaron and Miriam how they could even think of speaking against Moses. How dare you speak against the one that I honor? Dads, what are children observing about us? What are children observing about our walk with Jesus Christ? Do they see us living in fellowship with the Lord? Do they know that our relationship with God takes priority over everything and everyone else? Are we taking the spiritual leadership, setting the spiritual tone in our families? Do our children see us reading the Bible? Do they hear us praying for them? If you have children living at home, are you teaching them the importance of regular church attendance and involvement by your own example? Are you instilling in them a love for the Word and an importance of obedience to Christ? Do they see the glow of Jesus in you, the fruit of the Spirit evident in your life, the way that you treat your wife, their mother, the way that you interact with them? Those of us who have children that are grown, no longer living at home, but perhaps have children of their own who make us a grandfather or a pop-pop or whatever they call you, what spiritual impact are we having on them? You know, I pray regularly for my two grandsons that at a very early age they would embrace Jesus Christ as their Savior and Lord, and that God would use them to reach their generation with the gospel of Jesus Christ. I may not live long enough to see that day, see the realizations of my prayer, but I am praying for them. I'm also praying that I might have a positive spiritual impact on their lives, that I might be a role model for them of humble, faithful service to Jesus Christ, and that they might see in me what it means to walk in fellowship with the Lord. My own life was greatly impacted by the life of my godly grandfather. His love for Christ and the Word of God and his humble, faithful service and love for people. And I want to have that similar impact, Lord willing, on my two grandsons and others that God might give me. I trust you have that same desire as a grandpa or a pop-pop or grandpa or grandfather, whatever they call you. You know, today we honor fathers. If you had or have a father who's humble, who has selfless concern for you, non-competitive, non-defensive spirit, you are blessed. And he deserves to be honored. If you had or have a father who was or is faithful, who keeps his commitments, works hard, provides for his family, refuses to bail out, you, my friends, are blessed. They deserve to be honored. And thanked. And if you had a father or have a father who was or is spiritually minded, who lives in fellowship with the Lord, who loves the Lord with all their heart, who has spiritual concern for you, who sought to train you and seeks to train you in the things of God, who models the truth in front of your eyes, my friends, you are blessed. Your father deserves to be honored today. Now, I would dare say that none of us here will ever be nominated for the National Father's Day Committee Father of the Year Award. But all of us can be nominated by God for His Father of the Year Award. For what God honors is attainable by all. All of us can be humble and humble ourselves under the mighty hand of God. All of us can love our families with a love that comes from Him, with that selfless concern. We can develop a non-competitive, non-defensive attitude and stance. We can humble ourselves to serve our families. That's something we can do. All of us can be faithful, keeping commitments we've made to our wives, to our children, to our God. and all of us can live in fellowship with the Lord and set the spiritual tone for our family.